is on Zoom. Okay, call to order. So, John Updike. Not here yet.
He's excused.
He's excused, okay. So we'll skip around. Miss Yor Escobar.
Mr. Escobar is here today.
Mr. Bear.
Here.
Mr. Gary East.
Here.
Mr. Jim Ears Hanselman.
He's here.
Mr. Bear is here.
You did that already. Oh, he did.
Oh, yeah. Mr. Berman.
Here.
Okay, we're all here.
Well, Mr. Capri.
Mr. Capri's not here.
He's excused as well.
Okay. First order is new business. And under new business, we have the 2025 State of Oregon Legislative Update.
Thank you. Derek Tokos, Community Development. Well, during the legislative session, I had shared with you some of the bills, and we, in fact, had actually implemented SB 2138, which is on this list as well. And so my plan is to just kind of touch on each of these. I was going to go through this just on each of the bills and what the relevance is. Most of them do not require any additional work at the local level. They're just changes to the state law, but, you know, that are relevant to us or funding streams that are potentially relevant to us but don't require us to change the zoning code. 2138 was one of the bills that did, and I did run into one other one, House Bill 2005, which we need to pick up as well, which I'll be prepared to cover in work session, but I also have some highlighted language for the public hearing on the housekeeping that addresses it, and I'll note what that is. So let's moving right along. I have it up on the screen up there. I'm just going to kind of run through these. The first one was SB 5528, but that's Department of Land Conservation and Development's budget that was approved. What you'll see here is what was legislatively adopted has them at 111 positions, so they're staffing up a bit. I think I've been led to believe a lot of that has to go with the HAPO, or the Housing Accountability and Production Office, that they stood up as part of the governor's housing initiatives to work with and or prod local governments to make changes that they believe will help accelerate the construction of housing. Other thing to keep in mind is about $16 million for this, a little over almost $17 million for this biennium has been programmed for local government grants. Most of those are going to be going to jurisdictions that have not started or are in the queue to start their housing capacity analysis and production strategies. We've finished that. So we're not in that same position. We have made a request for funding to assist on one of our implementation measures in the housing production strategy, which relates to small to medium-sized cities, like Newport, trying to stand up rental housing maintenance inspection programs. We took a run at that previously, and they liked the concept but weren't prepared to provide grant funding if the city wasn't going to implement the program. Their suggestion was, adjust the grant request, make it more of a toolkit, for small to medium-sized cities who are interested in standing up rental housing maintenance inspection programs. And so we went ahead and submitted a grant request. It's tailored that way. We'll see what happens with that. That's a particular topic area where we heard a lot from Newport residents about, the condition of some of the rental units that are available at market rate are really poor, and we think the city should be playing a role in inspecting, ensuring that those units are habitable. That type of program is not common for smaller jurisdictions. It tends to be larger jurisdictions with more capacity who can tackle that kind of thing. So thus the request for a toolkit for them to.
Do the rental assistance to get them up to standards. Does that include the, we have a lot of, if you want to say, trailer housing around here, some of which are in very poor condition. Does that apply to that, or this is only structures on land?
Whether or not it's a manufactured dwelling or a recreational vehicle or your conventional stick-built dwelling, my suspicion is that the program, I mean, the toolkit piece that if we get funded, would view all of them as being within the realm of what's subject to inspection. Now, your options for addressing something in a trailer or a manufactured dwelling are going to be different than, say, in a conventional stick-built, but I would expect that anything that's being made available, any unit that's being made available as a rental for housing would be within the realm of what would be subject to that kind of a program.
And would this be, that program would probably exclude short-term rentals because they have their own provisions, or would it?
Correct, it would not include short, that's an excellent point. No, that type of program would be for month-to-month rentals. Short-term rentals under a different program. They have their own inspections, but it's more lodging style. And again, you know, this is not a commitment for the city of Newport to stand up a program, but to get a better, at least move the dial on that discussion point, say, okay, you know, if we were, what are our options? Are they reasonable given the resources we have available?
This looks, there is no total of, oh, there it is, total, 84 down to 76. Is that a significant?
What are you looking at, Bob?
The DLCD budget still. Total last go around was 84 million, and this year it's 76 million.
Yeah, but then you look at their FTE equivalents. So what that tells me is they've reduced grant funding. I have to go and look, but that's my suspicion. They've reduced one-time funds, but their staffing is actually up. And just so you know, the federal funds component of that does tend to be the coastal program. So that tends to be the DLCD staff that work most closely with us. The coastal program, that's where a lot of the federal money is. It's funneled through NOAA. And so what's legislatively adopted may not actually be what materializes from the federal government. So this is their assumption. That's the best they could make at the time. But, you know, decisions on federal funding are still being played out. So it's hard to say whether or not all of that's going to make it to the state or not.
I had a question on that. I don't know what the term package means in this context, but package 100, the very first one, it says eliminates climate resiliency position. That a policy or just circumstances that it happens to be a program that our federal government would have no use for?
They don't believe in it.
Right.
Well, it,
in other words, are we seeing a result of the big, beautiful bill? Or
I can't tell you that. I don't know. I'd have to ask and see kind of what that was.
It's just probably done.
It seems, my suspicion is not so much, and I say that because these are policy option packages that DLCD had to submit early in the legislative cycle. And the timing, I don't think, would align there. So this strikes me more of something that they were just trying to line up their staff resources with their upcoming responsibilities, and that's how it played out.
Okay, so.
But that's what these are. These are policy option packages. Every state department submits those along with their proposed budget early in the process, and so that's they're basically. The legislature, if you agree with what we're trying to do in these policy options, they would be, you know, add packages above and beyond what our normal budget would allow for.
Okay, thank you.
Package 504 is, I'm not quite understanding. It looks to me like they're trying to build housing on wetlands.
Here's the genesis of that, as I understand it, because it's been a hot button issue for some time, not so much for us, but for some of the jurisdictions in the valley where what is being construed as a wetland is getting to the point of ridiculous. Clogged catch basin causes some wetland plants to pop up. All of a sudden, now that's a jurisdictional wetland. And then the permitting process for that becomes a monumental hurdle. So I think it's really about, you know, getting a better understanding what really are wetlands and what are not wetlands, and those that really don't warrant that kind of protection, and, you know, like the clogged catch basin example I just provided, get winnowed out and are no longer an obstacle to housing construction. I do not see this or suspect that this has anything to do with building on pristine wetlands. But you'd be amazed about what gets pulled in and now becomes a wetland because of, you know, somebody regraded their property. Now you got a depression in there, and you get this isolated, tiny little wetland, and throws the whole project into a, you know, an issue. And all it is the presence of, you know, just a small amount of wetland plants.
I have seen regulations based on the size of the wetlands, but there's nothing that is, there's no indication of how this is supposed to roll out. So, of course, I'm going to question it.
And we'll see how they end up utilizing those funds, you know. But that's my understanding.
Acceptable.
I'm going to skip past House Bill 5006 at the close of session. Just allocated some property to other jurisdictions for land acquisition. It has nothing to do with us. HB 2347 included technical fixes for to housing legislation. Most of it's just clarification and statute. There wasn't anything that I saw that we needed to do locally. Some is just cleaning up confusing language. They did similar with SB 48, which had some technical fixes to SB 1537, which we've implemented already. So I didn't see anything there. That would one-time UGB site additions, but again, we're working off statutory rules at that point. We don't codify urban growth boundary rules. It's just, yeah, a different playing field there. HB 2138, we have actually discussed ad nauseum to a point because, you know, we're incorporating those code provisions as part of our housekeeping measures. So you've already seen 2138. We've gone through it in detail. You note that they don't require all of these changes until January of 28, but the scale of change, scope of changes for a community of our size were pretty modest. So it made sense to just get them in now.
All right. The very last paragraph there, I was a little, couldn't understand what they were getting at.
Expedited and middle housing land divisions?
Well, the one that says require local governments to implement a density bonus. Right before the makes the due date for city and county compliance, 2027.
Allows. Oh, we included that in there. This was the dense. There's a dense in the housekeeping provisions. If the housing was affordable, they got one additional unit. Remember that provision's in there in terms of our changes. So if it's affordable, so you're talking about affordable at 80% or less median area income, then they would get a density bonus of being able to have one additional unit on the property. And that is in the changes that you have on the public hearing.
Okay,
tonight.
I didn't recall that. So that, but we've already talked about it.
Yes, it's right in there.
So it's not the kind of situation where we end up with on single family lot, you know, three or four units because of you got an ADU and then, you know.
You get one additional dwelling unit. So it's not, the density bonus is not all that aggressive.
Okay.
I was a little lost in the summary of 2138 near the bottom of page 4. And it says,
oops,
defined UULs as within a UGB, zoned for urban development and not for future urbanization. What is the difference between urban development and urbanization?
Okay. So the provision you're looking at actually applies to counties. And so when they're talking about unincorporated urban lands, it's like Seal Rock. These are areas that are not in cities, but still allow for rural residential development at certain densities. I frankly don't pay much attention to it because it's not applicable to Newport at all. Because it's out, it's they're outside our urban growth boundary.
Okay.
Okay, HB 2316 is the has to do with the state-owned lands for housing. That's not one that the state put up a website at one point. There was only one property that we had that was state-owned that was even in, you know, potentially eligible for the state to make available for housing. That was up at the quarry, way up at the north side of town, and not really viable. And they acknowledged that what they had put out on their webs on the web was included a lot of properties that wouldn't, at the end of the day, you know, they showed state ownership, but they're not really suitable for housing. So it really has no impact on us. There are some other areas in the state where cities have quite a bit of state-owned property, some of which would be suitable for housing, but they just don't have it here. Sorry, I may have skipped over one. Oh, no. It was all 2138 above. Yep, okay. Oh, yeah, HB 2258. This is there are two pieces of this. One of them allows the Building Codes Division to establish pre-approved building plans. And so, you know, this is not the first time this concept has been tried and done. Portland did it, I want to say, in the late 90s. Into the early 2000s, where they'd have a stock set of building plans that say, okay, if you build exactly like this, you don't have to go through plan review. You know, you just pull your building permit and go under construction. Plans are already pre-approved. The challenges you run into with those kind of programs, and we'll see how the Building Codes Division addresses it, are kind of twofold. One, it's rare that somebody wants to build exactly per a stock plan. They tend to want to have to, I'd like this, but I'd like to do an addition, or I'd like to reorient it, I'd like to not have it look quite like this. I want to put the kitchen over here, and I want to do this over here. And as soon as you start modifying them, you're off the stock plan. Then the other is the challenge of keeping those stock plans up to date. Building codes change, and you know, so every few years, you know, you have to go back in and update those plans to comply or make sure they comply with the latest set of building safety codes. And that was always a challenge as well. But we'll see where they end up with that. The other part of that bill has to do with the LCD working through LCDC to have some stock parameters for approving residential development. I'm not sure what that's going to look like, but that it allows them to adopt rules requiring local governments approve housing under certain clear and objective standards. It's about like basically saying, okay, here's a set of clear and objective standards that every city has to allow housing to develop under. Because our clear and objective standards don't look like Lincoln City's or look like Portland's or look like Corvallis's or so on and so forth. There are differences, garage setbacks, building heights, all that kind of stuff, max amount of lot coverage. It's different from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. What this is saying is they'd come up with a standard set of, if they're prepared to live within these clear and objective standards, you have to approve it, period. Boom, you know, so we'll see where they end up going. If they, you know, it allows them to do the rule. I don't know exactly where they're, you know, how, what kind of priority, how quickly that piece is going to move. 3031 is your housing infrastructure financing program. This was the money that goes along with that the legislature allocated for infrastructure needed to support housing. It's not much. I mean, I don't mean to belittle $10 million. $10 million's a lot of money when you're thinking about maybe, you know, a handful of projects. But statewide, $10 million in lottery bond proceeds, this is not going to go very far. You know, when you're looking at a lot of capital projects, in of themselves are well over $1 million. So, We did talk about SB 974. There's no place for us to really codify it. It had two pieces. One, now our engineering department's on 120-day clock, just like planning. But there's nothing in the zoning ordinance for us to amend in that regard. We just have to make sure that their reviews are happening within our timelines. And then the other piece had to do with exempting design standards for housing projects of over 20 units. It was fairly narrowly tailored and it doesn't really apply to us. So it wasn't something we needed to codify. Moderate income housing pre-development loans was some adjustments they've made. It's a loan program, well, to take a look at it, but it doesn't require anything on the code. Residential sprinkler system, SDCs. There was a bill by Rep. Marsh, who this House Bill 3505, where local governments can't charge system development charges for sprinkler systems for residential development with sprinkler systems on a meter. Our SDCs are not structured where that would be an issue. We don't do a meter-based assessment for the residential on that, so it's not going to come up. And then on multifamily, which is where you'd have the dedicated, maybe a dedicated fire line for that purpose, we wouldn't charge anyway. So it makes sense. Well, you don't want to be charging system development charges for something that's really not impacting your system. And a sprinkler system doesn't do that. It's not like it's, landscaping or something, sinks and toilets and showers, which are running all the time. You use a sprinkler system, hopefully never.
Never.
3144 gets at making CCNRs that prohibit the siting of manufactured housing unenforceable. You'll note that would be CCNRs in effect on or after the effective date of the bill. So they're not claiming that they can go and modify a CCNR that was, say, put in place a decade ago. They're saying it's prospective moving forward. Again, nothing we need to do anything about in our code. 3145, this is Lyft. So this is a program you're going to see the Northwest Coastal Housings of the World, the Habitats, and others that are seeking state funding to construct affordable housing projects. That's the program that funds it, and so that was the latest allocation for Lyft and via HB 3145. On the urbanization front, we don't do urban reserves, so SB 1129 doesn't really come into play. HB 2647, this tells you just the state of play when it comes to urban growth boundary land exchanges, when a city has to get a bill passed for them to do a UGB land exchange, and that's what Monmouth had to do. That tells you the administrative rules for doing a UGB land swap aren't working particularly well. If cities have to go that route.
Why would they have to go that route and we don't?
I mean, we could potentially do that.
No, I mean, they're obviously doing it as a last.
We haven't. Look, we had that 40-acre piece up on the north side of town where we took a run at it. And I guess theoretically we could try to get a bill to circumvent the rules. Right now, those rules are being amended, so it wouldn't make any sense on our end. I suspect Monmouth and Roseburg were further along in that process before they hit the wall, and that's why they went the legislative route. Roseburg was the next one, HB 3921. HB 2356 has to do with metro service districts, annexations. Nothing we need to change in our code. Resource lands, that's all outside UGBs, so I didn't spend much time looking at these. Remember, Department of Land Conservation Development, they deal with the entire state. So they're listing stuff that's specific to counties and unincorporated areas. along with the stuff that's relevant to cities. All the resource land stuff, that's outside our urban growth boundary. That'd be your farm and forest, typically. So some of this gets at, you know, contested cases relating to transmission lines, which are often proposed in some areas where you have high-value farmland or, you know, sensitive sites and wind energy projects, those kind of things. SB 75 doesn't really come into play for us, but SB 83 does, and I just want to, this is, SB 83 was the bill that basically repealed the state wildlife hazard map that had been developed in 2021 and became a political hot potato because of, you know, people were like, wait a minute, you're designating our property as a high risk. Now we can't, our insurance is going to be higher or we're not going to be able to get insurance. And so there was a lot of that going along. And originally in 2023, the Oregon Residential Specialty Code included a new chapter, R327, which includes hardening provisions for construction in areas at risk of wildfire. So think of, you know, roof vents that are designed to prevent embers from getting into your attic. So just think of a whole battery of those types of provisions that are designed to make a house more resilient, more likely to not burn down in the event of a wildfire. And so that's what's in there. But when they added them in 2023 to the residential code, it was all tied to the maps. If you were a high-risk area, that's when that provision would apply. And Newport, and our area was not identified as high-risk. Therefore, we didn't pay too much attention to it. Now, with SB 83, what they said is, well, we're repealing the statewide hazard maps, and now we're just going to defer to local jurisdictions. And so what we're going to end up doing is Joseph and I are going to meet with our fire chief, Rob Murphy, and kind of look at our area, you know, within the, and see if there are any areas within our city limits or areas that may be annexed where we think some of these defensible space requirements should be applied for new construction and come forward with recommendations once we've had a chance to meet. Stay tuned on that one. Because, you know, while we weren't listed as a high risk, I mean, Echo Mountain wasn't that far away. So I think, you know, so, I mean, yes, relative to areas like Bend and Sisters and La Pine and some of those other areas that are pretty significant risk, you know, yeah, we're not as high as them, but we still have to be cognizant of the risk because it could happen. And we know it could happen because of, you know, examples like Echo Mountain. Marcy, was Mabel make it good? Or Ocean and Coastal, 2925. That's Oregon Park and Rec, who does the permitting on the beaches, is retooling their permitting process. That's what that bill dealt with. There's one that deals with offshore wind, which had been a priority of the prior administration at the federal level, not so much under the current. But all those initiatives were well underway, and so that's what that bill relates to. SB 179 gets at rec immunity. This one's for landowners who make the property available for recreational purposes. SB 504 gets at...
excuse me, didn't we have an issue, where was it, over on...
below the reservoir, between the reservoir and... Agate Beach Wayside.
Oh, in there? Yeah, I thought there was one that went down the cliff to the beach, too, over off Spring Street.
That I don't know
where
about.
The landowner shut down the trail because they were afraid they'd get sued.
Not sure. I don't recall on that one, Bob.
Well,
but anyway, this is
a good
this
idea.
This addresses it.
Yeah.
SB 504 gets at alternative natural-based solutions for shoreline stabilization. You know, alternatives to riprap. Again, we don't have to make a code change for that kind of stuff. Same with territorial seas. Here's the one where we do need to make a change, and I'll talk about it during the public hearing because I added some language. They snuck in this 68-page little citing of psychiatric and behavioral health care facilities, some land use regulations in HB 2005. Here's what it is. I'm going to show you real quick.
Well, I had one quick question before you get into the guts. It says within the land zone for residential, commercial, employment, and industrial uses. So there, some places have employment zones. We don't.
Commercial. That translates to commercial.
Oh, okay.
Here's the verbiage specifically. It's like on page, I think, well, sections 58 and 59. So it's towards the bottom of the bill. You'll see some language in here. And just to be clear, what we're talking about here are residential treatment facilities and residential treatment homes. So, you know, what Samaritan built up in Agga Beach, that's a residential treatment facility. So I think it's under 5 or under 6 is the home. Between like 6 and 15 is a treatment facility. So matter of scale, that's what they are. What this effectively means is we have to allow them in all residential zoned areas, all commercial zoned areas, and employment zoned areas, and on public lands, and for industrial uses, if it's publicly owned or it's owned by a public benefit corporation and it's proximate to residential areas, 250 feet. And it's not specifically designated for heavy industrial use. So it's got that caveat for industrial. So it does mean we need to make a change because currently we don't allow them in R1 and R2, just R3 and R4. And we don't specifically call them out as allowed in our commercial and industrial areas. So I put some language together for that purpose.
But it's just a change to the matrix?
Yeah. Yeah, we don't have a choice. I mean, and that's the thing. It's not a may. It's, you know, so.
We can still keep them out of inundation zones, so I assume.
Correct. Yeah. And I checked the overlay. Thank you, Bob. I checked the tsunami hazard overlay, and we have them covered there already. So we're good there. So we wouldn't. And that, if you read all the way down through the language, it talks about this is not intended to preclude, you know, you from restricting them in hazardous areas or areas of cities deemed as hazardous.
And it doesn't matter the number of beds at these facilities?
Well, you're not going to go over 16. I believe that's what the definition for residential treatment facility. It's either 5 or 6 to 15 is the treatment facility. That's the bigger of the two. Yes. And then the smaller is home.
Ah. So. Thank you.
So I'll stop sharing on that one. Go back into the bill. Oh, it's almost done with the list here. So we just talked about HB 2005. Uh, 2258's not something. It deals with a private right of action on properties for conservation purchase purposes, makes reference to illegally created lots. This is not really an issue for us. Uh, 2658 gets at frontage improvements. Does not apply to us. We're not a municipality over 15,000. There's a HB 2067 created a tribal task force. Just looks like it's to clarify and improve communication with state agencies. HB 3136, real estate professionals on planning commissions. We talked about that one, actually, I think, during the middle of the legislative session. Just clarified how many members you can have on a commission. Child care facility siting expansion, I checked, we're good. We already have them all listed as permitted, so we don't need to do anything special for 3560. 3569 deals with when rules advisory committees are set up, like DLCD does a bunch of them. This is intended to try to get them to pull in the sponsors of the bills to make sure that they're actually, the rules are implementing the bills the way the proponents intended them to. SB 967, I'm going to take a look at it at some point. I'm not sure exactly what its angle is, but it's getting it, I think, local improvement districts and how they can be implemented where you have multiple governmental entities involved. Keep in mind, you know, we provide water and wastewater services at a municipal level, but there are a lot of areas where those are special districts. So the city doesn't provide that service. It's a third-party district. So it might get into that arena. Appeal fees were increased to LUBA. That's what they were. Preschools and places of worship, we already allow that, so there wasn't anything specific for us to have to implement there. So that's it. That's all I had listed. Actually, was fairly modest when it came to, compared to some of the last few sessions where they've required local governments make fairly significant changes to their codes. This one's reasonably modest. You have any questions? Other questions?
No, nothing is in the works about transient room tax flexibility.
Oh, I'm sure it'll come up again. It was close this last session, just didn't get through. It was very close. Because if memory serves, it had cleared the House and it had hearing at the Senate, and it didn't move from there.
We can hope.
Yeah.
Next item is the review of the City Center Revitalization Plan for Design Guidelines.
Thank you. So the Planning Commission's had a chance to now over a couple of work sessions to kind of work through the form-based code for the City Center District as it relates to the clear and objective standards. But we're setting this up as a design district, much like Nye Beach, and in doing so, we have a clear and objective path, and then we have an alternate path somebody can choose to go down electively, which has design guidelines, and it would go to a public hearing before the Planning Commission. And so, you know, for this meeting, Marcy and her folks over at Herbsworks have put together 10 design guidelines for you to take a look at, and they've been working on some graphics to pair with that. And I think at this point, I'd like to turn it over to Marcy so she can kind of begin to walk through those with you. How are you doing, Marcy? Can you hear me okay?
Yes, I can hear you great. And can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can hear you. Did you have anything you wanted to share, or do you want me to put anything on the screen?
I could share my printout of the text.
Okay.
If that would be helpful, then we can go through it one by one and take comments.
Okay.
That would be really helpful for me to hear what comments everybody has about these documents. So, first of all, is this large enough to be readable?
Nope. We need to go single page on that one, Marcy.
We have.
How's that?
That's good. And you have those in your packets.
Okay. There it is. Yeah. All right.
So, if you want to get to the first one here, connected PED network.
So let me just, before we go through each one, I'd like to explain that these follow the template. We used as a template the Nye Beach Design Guidelines, where it has a design guideline title, and then it has an intent statement, and then it has some approaches in form of a bullet list. And the approaches are intended to be different ways that you could meet the goal, the intent. And then we have 10 different guidelines right now, and I'll just tell you what they are. Sorry, was somebody saying something? So as an overview, we have connected pedestrian network, support the multimodal network, universal design, commercial frontages, residential frontages, landscape frontages, roof form, scaling and orientation, site design and open space, and finally, parking design and orientation. And there was one more thing I was going to say about this. We have an applicability section that this varies a little bit from what you have in Nye Beach, but since we have these three sub areas and those are described more fully in the based code, we have the traditional downtown area, and then we have the Highway 20 or Olive Street Gateway area, and then we have the Highway 101 Gateway area, was to the south of the traditional downtown. And some of these standard guidelines won't apply to some of those areas. And I guess the other thing to say here before I launch in is that these will ultimately be illustrated with photos and diagrams. Many of the same photos and diagrams that are in the form-based code would be used to illustrate the intent statement of the different approaches. Does anybody have a question or comment at this point?
Nope.
Go ahead, please.
I'm ahead of you. I'm up at guideline 5, so I will wait till you get there.
Okay. Maybe I could just ask a preference. Do people want me to go through these one by one, or do you already have some comments that you'd like to share with me?
I have a comment on design guideline 1 for a question.
All right. Perfect. Why don't you ask that question?
Specialty paving is encouraged. What is specialty paving?
This is actually a approach statement that you have in Nye Beach. And specialty paving could be a different paving material, say that's different from the public work standard sidewalk material.
Pervious pavement would be one.
Pervious, yeah,
right.
Stamped, some sort of, or etched surfacing could fall into that category too.
Okay. And then the other question I have, I guess not a question, the last bullet point, provide pedestrian scale lighting to provide safety and comfort to users. So I assume the lighting mm-hmm. we're putting in there is compliant with the dark skies initiative.
Do you have a dark sky ordinance?
We've tried. I don't know that we do.
But we're leaning and asking all new developments to include that.
We do have some
developers have been satisfied to try to meet our request.
We do have some language about downward directed in a number of different areas of the code.
Okay, so we do have it. Okay.
We can add that additional language. We can borrow it from your other language, downward directed lighting. I mean, it could be that simple.
That would be good.
All right, thank you. So I do believe that these standards would meet all of the, or would be applicable to all of the areas, because this is kind of a core, very important guideline. So if I could move to support the multimodal network, this is a little different in that and goes above and beyond what number one is about, which is really supporting the pedestrian in terms of wayfinding and lighting. This is really about supporting all the things that we're trying to create, especially in the downtown, traditional downtown area, by creating a buffered bike lane and wider sidewalks with benches and street trees, and also trying to coordinate with the transit stops where they exist and where they're proposed. So we want to make sure that is really, really easy for somebody to choose a mode of getting around that's not a car. So obviously, if we're going to have a protected bike lane and put all that investment into having a really first-class bike amenity, we'd want to make sure that people can ride their bike directly to where they're going. So we want bike racks. Now, this doesn't go into the you must have this number, they must be located here. This is really just a guideline as opposed to a standard. We're also trying to explain. Yeah, please.
Oh, I was going to say, do we need to have a guideline on the use of electric bikes versus regular bikes? I mean, if they're using the bike lane, a lot of people with those electric bikes, you know, they're going 25 miles an hour. So if I'm using my bike, which I use, you know, would use my feet to pedal it.
You know, I think
I'm probably going 5 miles an hour.
You don't want to be run down.
Yeah, I don't want to be run down.
You know, at some point along with scooters and things of that nature too, that those are things the city probably wants to wrangle with, but it wouldn't be in the context of a design district.
Okay.
That might be more of your general traffic safety rules, which fall under a different part of the municipal code. And we'd have to, that conversation would involve the police department and probably engineering.
Okay, fair enough.
I had a question there. Why is the wayfinding only to assist cyclists and not walkers and drivers?
I know. I saw that too. I don't agree with that. So we'll be making a change that the wayfinding should really be oriented to every person using every mode. But it is important that cyclists know where they could park and or where they can ride next. One of the issues I know that some community members have shared with us is that there's going to be a really nice bike lane here and on 9th, but it won't be completely clear where that goes after you're done in traveling on your bike through the traditional downtown. So it's important for wayfinding to emphasize that how someone connects up with the local street, the local streets that are supportive of bicyclists, because or other bike paths that exist. But we will change this so that it's more broad and covers more modes.
Okay. On the bike lanes, as a design element, as the bike lane approaches a stoplight, should we put in that we need, I call it, 10 feet or something, painted green, I guess, or whatever, to try to remind car drivers who are taking a right turn that, as far as the bicyclist is concerned, that, there could be some bicycles there. And if you'd make too sharp a turn and the bike sees a green light and takes off, we're going to have a collision. So kind of a safety thing for...
You're talking about a bike box, what's called a bike box. It's some slightly in the intersection of the cars don't cut the corner. And I think that's something we can mention here. It does verge into the public works standards.
We want to outline different approaches that they can take, but we don't want to specify specific solutions. That's going to be a function of the location of the project and what does or does not comport with our traffic safety rules at that location.
Well, I mean, when I'm up in Portland, I see that all the time.
Sure, you bet.
And that's an intelligent thing to do. So I don't know, maybe it should be part of our, of a discussion over safety in the city.
I think, Derek, it's kind of, it would be kind of nice to include a statement in here that's more general about supporting, using kind of like the best practices for supporting bicyclists.
Sure.
Especially at intersections and in the design of the street and the design of the intersections or something like that.
Okay.
Okay. So actually, I also don't totally agree with the applicability here. I'm saying we sent this out on Friday, and I had a staff person working with me closely on it. And I've already thought of some things that I want to add. So I think that this is applicable to Highway 101 South. Certainly, even though we're not going to have a bike lane running on that segment, we will still have bicyclists crossing that street. And I think we should be thinking about how they can do so safely, and also how bus stops work on that segment.
Marcy, could you hold on just a minute? Yes, sir.
I didn't hear that.
Well, if you're gonna, gonna make a statement, please come up to the microphone.
Yeah, I was.
So tell us your name and where you
name,
live.
My name is Troy Arundel. I was just recently come back from the valley and stuff, and seeking residence.
Did you talk into the microphone?
And seeking residence. So I don't know if I want to go into detail about things, but I see the upkeep being done. Corvallis is totally revamped. Their structures. Every building, every single building has been painted and remodeled. So this is the structure that's going on here, and it's going on everywhere. So on the bike path, I mean, Corvallis is pretty good. I mean, it's a biking world over there, but their improvements can be great. I mean, figure, you know, we're looking at New Israel. Of the West Coast, the two East Flow Rivers. So this is where it first comes and serves, is this, and it goes it goes there. I suggest a path and a train system to the valley, so we have people can come down here and live, and then go to school there, as well. We got a path already that goes from the coast to here. Pacific Trestle, I've seen the trail. It's a creek. It runs up to Corvallis. It's an old trail that migrated up to during the gold rush. So I know there's work being done on this to bring that old path back. It's solid. So
we're talking here tonight about the simply the downtown area and Highway 20.
Highway 20.
And what kind of standards we ought to apply to development there. So
right, and we have a short period of time.
Okay.
But there's after this, we have a regular meeting, and there's some forms over there. If you want to comment longer, you can fill out the form and turn it in here.
Okay.
And we'll let you speak.
What about the bus system you're talking about? Now, Corvallis is free. Can you do
okay,
that
well,
here?
That has, but okay. That really doesn't have anything to do here. But your comments are valid, but this is specific meetings.
Time.
It's not the right time.
All righty.
The next meeting would be a better time, so if you could fill that out.
Give me about 10 or 15 minutes, and we'll have the.
All right. Thank you. Thank you.
Okay, Marcy.
So I'm going to move on to design guideline number three, which is a more general guideline about designing universal access from the building through the parking lot to the street, to the transit station, and it's really kind of to inspire in a discretionary review process for the designer to say how that they have designed their site and their building so it's cohesively designed for universal access. So it's more, it includes a kind of potpourri of different approaches. I don't think this is actually the full list myself, and I think that we will also have more pictures to show how, especially in parking lots, for example, having a path, a seamless path that gets you through the parking lot while walking and biking, et cetera. So any comments about this guideline in general?
Curbless street design, I'm not exactly sure what that is, but unless it's just as it states. And doesn't that conflict with all our design standards for street cross sections?
This would be more for the internal block connections, and you have some really great examples of curbless street designs in Nye Beach. You're actually kind of a pioneer in terms of the design. Can't remember the name of the street that runs parallel to coastal, that is near the Silver Beach Hotel, but that's an example of a curbless street.
Yeah, we do that.
Okay.
Also, curbless street design is definitely it's behind the thinking about the Festival Street on Herbert, Lee, and Alder.
Yep.
Okay. So any other comments about this one, this guideline? All right. So at the last Planning Commission that I attended, we talked about the commercial frontages in the form-based code, and there's literally some clear and objective standards for how you meet some commercial frontages. This is a really important aspect, especially to the traditional downtown, and making sure that we get a really high quality response in the buildings that responds to the level of investment that's going into the street. So we had in the frontage types in the form-based code, things like a required floor-to-ceiling height. You remember that discussion. So this is more general statement encouraging a developer or property owner to increase their the kind of commercial supporting nature of their buildings. So it's a generalization in more discretionary language of all of the different things that our frontage types require. I don't know if you have want to go through this line by line. I'd really rather just take your general comments about it. Are we missing anything?
Apparently not.
I guess I have a question about businesses located on the corners. You want an active streetscape experience using signage, landscaping, street furnishings, lighting. I don't want to see distractions at a corner. You have people turning, you have people on sidewalks, you have people crossing. I want people focused on their vehicles and driving safely, not having their view garnered by a flashing light or, as we had down in Nye Beach, a 36-inch or 42-inch TV in a real estate shop that was right at a corner. I think distractions are a real problem. Maybe that second bullet point isn't going to create the situation that I see, but I certainly believe it could. So
we could qualify that bullet with a little that no distractions, flashing lights, signage, etc. So we can describe some limitations on the corner treatment. Would that be an acceptable response?
That'd be better. That'd be better for sure.
And we'll have some.
My concern is simply safety.
Bill, just real quick, we're at 7, but you know, we have the two noticed hearings, but those hearings are scheduled to start at no earlier than 7. So my advice would be to let Marcy kind of go through the balance of this, take another 15 minutes or so to get through this.
Okay. I was about to tell Marcy we were getting close to the regular meeting, so we just needed to speed it up.
Well, then, why don't we go straight to the person who had a comment about this one? And you can let me know your comment.
That was myself, and I will simply state that on the second bullet point, where you're talking about lighting along walkways and front doors at residential buildings, I too would like to see that be downward lighting, showing the sidewalk, showing the steps. It doesn't have to light up the sky.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Sure.
Robert?
Yeah, I just have just one quick question. It's about the signage, such as blade signs and sandwich board signs. And it says a clear walking path shall be maintained at all times. Avoid overcrowding the sidewalk with furnishings. Are there going to be restrictions on the size of the sandwich board signs?
Yeah, we have those in our sign code. And I can bring those forward for you to take a look at.
There will also be zones on the sidewalk that are not, where signs and furniture is not permitted, or a clear walking zone.
Thank you.
I'm going to actually stop sharing and just ask, in the interest of getting you onto your next agenda item, did people have any other comments about the other 5 guidelines?
Marcy, I would just share with you on the roofs under design guidelines 7 bullet 1, you will want to align the range of roof pitches in the guidelines so that it matches up with what we have in the clear and objective standards.
Yeah, it's 2 and 12. That's the change that we made at the last meeting.
Right.
Thanks. If there are no other overarching comments, then I would say look for the next version of this, which will be more illustrated, and the text can still be added and tweaked at that time.
And then I have one final thing that I need Marcy for here. So just one moment. Okay. At the end of the last work session, we had talked about the triggering mechanisms that mandate discretionary review. And we went through those that are in place for Nye Beach. And that's principally any structure that's over 65 feet in length and 35 feet in height. But the conditions in Nye Beach are different than City Center. And there's, you know, the reasons these triggering mechanisms are in place is because you have a lot more lower profile development in Nye Beach, cottages, things of that nature, than you would say, you know, along the US 101 and 20 corridor. You have quite a bit more building mass historically. So, and I'm not sure they're the right triggering mechanisms. And Marcy, I don't know if you had a chance to put any additional thought to that. I know you were kind of kicking around your mind when we last had a work session.
I put into notes from that meeting, I think that we should increase the length to 50 feet in length. 50 feet in height,
right,
and 75 feet in length, because I do think the buildings, especially in the downtown area, are going to be bigger and longer, and it's not that same scale that we see in Nye Beach. Also, I recommended that we look at the housing development prototypes that we developed earlier in the project, the 3D models,
mm-hmm,
that we looked at during the code concepts. Most of those were, you know, quarter block, a fifth of a block long. So they're just the development we think is going to become feasible here that would deserve to be discretionary review I think it just needs to be a little bit bigger.
You guys comfortable with that? At least just moving forward with that in the draft and see how it goes?
Yep.
Yeah.
Okay. That's what we'll do.
Thank you, Ray.
Right. Thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Okay. Have a nice evening.
Okay. Thanks, Marcy.
You too. Thanks. Bye.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Okay. Next on the quick agenda here is the community development orientation for the city council.
Yeah, and I
information only.
Yeah, but just provide it for information.
In there. I like that one.
Yeah. John Updike had watched it because, you know, we, like all departments, we do a council orientation, and it was, ours was actually fairly, relatively recent. And so, yeah, that provides kind of a pretty, you know, in-depth overview of kind of what we have going on in community development.
Yeah, that was good. Okay. Yeah. Now we're moving to unfinished business.
I don't think we have any. We shouldn't have any. Okay. Just a work program update.
Work program. We won't have, after this, the next planning commission meeting is September 22nd, I think.
Should be it. Yep, September 22nd.
Dirk's going on vacation, I guess.
Out of the country.
Oh. No, Derek's going out of the country. Good for him. Okay. So that ends the work session. Next up is going to be the regular session, but Sherry's going to do something first.